Well, we'll begin with 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. I'm going to read through with only a few minor comments. I will translate a word here or there that our English translations may not have correct. So let's begin. There was a certain man from Ramathaim Zophim, from Mount Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Yerocham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, from the land of Ephraim. He had two wives. One's name was Hannah, and the name of the second was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man would ascend from his city from year to year to prostrate himself and to bring offerings to Adonai, master of legions, in Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were Kohanim to Adonai. It happened on the day that Elkanah brought offerings that he gave portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah, and Adonai had closed her womb. Her rival, Peninnah, provoked her again and again in order to irritate her, for Adonai had closed her womb. This is what he would do year after year, and whenever Peninnah would go up to the house of Adonai, she would provoke her. Hannah would cry and not eat. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you cry and why do you not eat? Why is your heart broken? Am I not better to you than 10 children?" Hannah arose after eating in Shiloh and after drinking. And Eli the Kohen was sitting on the chair near the doorpost of the sanctuary of Adonai. She was feeling bitter, and she prayed to Adonai, weeping continuously. She made a vow and said, "Adonai, master of legions, if you take note of the suffering of your maidservant, and you remember me and do not forget your maidservant, and give your maidservant male offspring, then I shall give him to Adonai all the days of his life, and a razor shall not come upon his head." It happened as she continued to pray before Adonai that Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking to her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk? Remove your wine from yourself." Hannah answered and said, "No, my lord, I am a woman of a grieved spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, and I have poured out my soul before Adonai. Do not deem your maidservant a daughter of Belial, for it is out of much grievance and anger that I have spoken until now." Eli then answered and said, "Go in peace. The God of Israel will grant the request you have made of him." She said, "May your maidservant find grace in your eyes." Then the woman went on her way and she ate. The look on her face was no longer the same. They arose early in the morning and prostrated themselves before Adonai. Then they returned and came to their home, to Ramah. Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and Adonai remembered her. And it happened with the passage of the period of days that Hannah had conceived, and she gave birth to a son. She named him Shmuel, for she said, "I requested him from Adonai." The man Elkanah ascended with his entire household to bring to Adonai the annual offering and his vow. But Hannah did not ascend, as she told her husband, "When the child is weaned, then I will bring him, and he shall appear before Adonai and shall settle there forever." Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what is good in your eyes. Remain until you wean him, but may Adonai fulfill his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. She brought him up with her when she weaned him with three bulls, one ephah of flour and a flask of wine. She brought him to the house in Shiloh, though the child was still tender. They slaughtered the bull and brought the child to Eli. She said, "Please, my lord, by your life, my lord, I am the woman who is standing by you here praying to Adonai. This is the child that I prayed for. Adonai granted me my request that I asked of him. Furthermore, I have dedicated him to Adonai. All the days that he lives, he is dedicated to Adonai." He then prostrated himself to Adonai. Then Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exults in Adonai. My horn has been raised through Adonai. My mouth is opened wide against my antagonist, for I rejoice in your Yeshua. There is none as holy as Adonai, for there is none besides you, and there is no rock like our God. Do not abound in speaking with arrogance upon arrogance. Let not haughtiness come from your mouth. For Adonai is the God of thoughts, and men's deeds are accounted by him. The bow of the mighty is broken, while the foundering are girded with strength. The sated ones are hired out for bread, while the hungry ones cease to be so. While the barren woman bears 7, the one with many children becomes bereft. Adonai brings death and gives life. He lowers to the grave and raises up. Adonai impoverishes and makes rich. He humbles and he even elevates. He raises the needy from the dirt. From the trash heaps he lifts the destitute, to seat them with nobles and to endow them with a seat of honor. For Adonai's are the pillars of the earth, and upon them he set the world. He guards the steps of his devout one, but the wicked are stilled in darkness. For not through strength does man prevail. Adonai, may those who contend with him be shattered. Let the heavens thunder against them. May Adonai judge to the ends of the earth. May he give power to his king and raise the horn of his Messiah. Elkanah then went to Ramah to his house, while the boy served Adonai before Eli the Kohen. The sons of Eli were sons of Belial. They did not know Adonai. Well, as I was reading this week, I spent most of it on the first 3 verses, because I purposed to read this through in Hebrew as well as in English, and there's some new vocabulary here I stumble over and have to check out and look up. So as I was reading through this, something jumped out at me that I would never have noticed otherwise. In the first 3 verses, we're introduced to 2 men. The first is Elkanah, and you see his name there as well as in Hebrew. And the name Elkanah means redeemed by God or possession of God. El is the simplest form of God's name. And Kana means to buy or redeem, to possess. On the other hand, Eli, at first I always thought it meant my God. There's El, God, and when you put a yud at the end of the word, it makes it first person possessive. So if you have a kli, a cup, kli'i, put the yud on the end, it becomes my cup. A shulkan, a table, you put a yud at the end, shulkani, becomes my table. So El, God, you put a yud at the end, Ali, becomes my God. In fact, when I looked up his name in one of the name dictionaries I have at home, it said, my God. But when you look at the Hebrew, that is not what it means. If you were to meet Eli and ask, what is your name? He would say, Eli. And you say, oh, that means my God, doesn't it? He would say, no, it sounds like that. But what it really means is my yoke. It sounds the same as Eli, my God, but it's actually Eli, my yoke. You know, when Yeshua was on the cross, he quoted Psalm 22, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? So there's something interesting about Eli, we find out right away. It sounds like his name means my God, but it simply means my yoke. Not God's yoke, my yoke. You know, Eli's a confusing person. Shouldn't be, because there are a lot of Eli's around. And every one of us has probably played an Eli sometime in our life, if we're not doing so right now. On the one hand, he's a priest. He's in this elevated position as high priest over Israel. On the other hand, he's sitting at the door of the temple. Now, there really wasn't a temple yet. The tabernacle had been located in Shiloh. It had been there for a few centuries, and eventually they'd replaced the curtains with a stone wall, and it had kind of taken up a permanent residence. He was getting a bit tattered and threadbare by this time. But Eli, instead of being on his feet serving, he's sitting at the doorpost. This is the only place I see where some priest is just sitting when he should be serving. It also tells us later in the narrative that he was a heavy man, meaning he was obese. And no wonder, when you see how his two sons, in the rest of chapter 2, his two sons would steal the sacrificial meat from those who would bring it to the altar. And apparently Eli was enjoying the benefits of their theft. But on the other hand, he was concerned when he saw a woman praying there in the courtyard and she appeared to be drunk. Because you see, in Jewish tradition, when you pray aloud. This is why the Siddur, the prayer book, is used. And prayers are always prayed aloud. And you go to the synagogue, the prayers are prayed aloud. And it's very unusual for someone to pray and their lips be moving, but no sound come out. So on the one hand, he's concerned about this woman who might be drunk. He didn't want that in his courtyard. On the other hand, he should have realized this woman isn't drunk. She's praying. And so Hannah had to correct his misperception. So he's not very discerning, is he? But then, he blesses Hannah and she has a child. So what can you say? And so Eli is this mixed bag. You know, you see these errors and these problems. On the other hand, God is still blessing him and using him in another way. And we're going to learn more about Eli in next week's teaching. But I kept thinking, how many of us, when we talk, our speech says, oh yes, God is my God. But in our lives, it just looks like we're yoked to something. We're just bearing a yoke. You know, we always talk about people who know God, and we want to encourage them to put on Yeshua's yoke, right? But I think it's possible to have the reverse as well. To try to put on the yoke of God without really knowing God. And that can be a very difficult existence. It has to be very laborious when you're wearing a yoke and you don't have him next to you, helping you along with this. But as I went on, the thing that really jumped out at me is the narrative introduces Elkanah as having two wives, Hannah and the second wife, Penina. Now, Penina is the second wife because probably what happened was when Hannah obviously could not bear children, Elkanah, who until then had no intention of taking a second wife, finally took a second wife because a man needed to have children. You didn't have health insurance in those days. You did not have a pension program. You didn't have a 501k or 401k or whatever it is. Obviously, I don't know much about those things either. So you had children. You brought up children. And these were what would take care of you when you were elderly. So since Hannah's womb was closed, he married Penina, and she was very fruitful. And then immediately afterward, we're introduced to the fact that Eli has two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Now I want you to look at something with these names. The first thing I want you to notice is this. You notice in Hophni's name, we'll just move from right to left, you notice how there's the pay nun. And then you come to the next person, Phinehas, and his name begins with Pei Nun. And then you go to Penina, and the first two letters are Pei Nun. But in Hannah, we don't find these two letters. The Nun, but not the Pei Nun. Pei Nun spells the word face. Face. Remember when Jacob wrestled with the angel? And when the sun came up, he realized, ooh, this is no angel, this is not an enemy, this is God. Wild story. And then the one he's wrestling with says, let me go. And Jacob says, I will not let you go till you bless me. And so this divine being says, what is your name? He says, Jacob. He says, no longer will be called Jacob, but Israel. So he changes Jacob's name to Israel. And finally he leaves. And then what does Jacob do? He sets a pillar up there and calls the place Penuel. For I have seen God face to face, yet my life is preserved. Penuel means face of El, face of God. So we see in Hophni and in Phinehas and in Peninnah, we find these two letters that spell face. In fact, the word Phinehas has a couple of possible translations. One is face of trust. Pinchas is how you'd pronounce it. But it can also mean the Pei Nachash, mouth of the serpent. Hophni, on the other hand, his name means boxer, a pugilist, a fighter. Peninnah means a pearl or a jewel, and possibly a jewel gets the name Peninnah, which has the word face in it, because you look at a pearl close enough, you see a reflection. Or you look at a polished gem, you'll see a reflection of your face in it. But then there's Hannah, whose name means grace. Her name means grace. Now, when you take this into consideration, here's the one whose name means grace or favor. And yet it seems like everybody else has favors except for the one whose name is grace or favor. Peninnah has all these children. Phinehas and Hophni, they're these two preacher's kids who are also playboys in the church, making a wealthy living off of the people who attend the place. They're sinning and seem to be getting away with it. But the one named Hannah, grace, favor, here she is. She's the one who has a heart for God, and she seems to be the most wretched of the lot. Now, there's an interesting thing that happens. You want to skip over to near the end of where we read, end of chapter, what about the middle of chapter 1? Chapter 1 and verse 18, you come to an interesting verse. Eli has blessed her, and in verse 18 she said, "May your maidservant find grace in your eyes." Then the woman went on her way and she ate, and the look on her face was no longer the same. Something happened in her at that time. She said, "May I find grace, chen, in your eyes." And her panay was changed. It was no longer the same. But let's point out something that you may have noticed already just from the overhead. And that is this. The initials of Elkanah's two wives are the same as the initials of Eli's two sons. You've got Hannah, which starts with Ket, and Peninnah, which starts with Pei. And over here you have Hophni, which starts with Ket, and Pinchas, which starts with Pei. Now these things just don't happen by coincidence. And here in the first three, four verses of Samuel, God's introduced us to two men. Both their names start with El. One has two wives, one has two sons, and they have the same initials. God is setting up something here. And it's one of these things I believe Yeshua refers to when he talks about every jot, every yud, every tagin, every tittle is placed in the Torah. And I think it also applies to Samuel, this inspired book of God. Why is God drawing our attention to these two letters? You know, if it just stopped here, I'd think, oh, maybe it is coincidence, though I don't believe in coincidence. But I think to understand what's going on here, we need to look at these two letters in greater detail. When you look at the letter Pei as it appears in the Torah scroll, it looks like this. It's much fancier than our regular printed letter Pei. And when you look at the letter Ket, this letter, as it's printed in the Torah scroll, it looks like this. It looks like two letter Zayins yoked together. What comes out of your Pei? What comes out of your mouth? The issues of the heart. What's on the inside comes out. And the letter Pei is even shaped like a mouth. This is the bottom jaw and the top jaw, and this is like the top lip here. And it's facing the left. But the letter Ket is made up of two letters that are identical. And the sages tell us that this little tiny thin broken line, or not broken, but bent line here, you know what they call that? They call that a yoke. that these two letters are yoked together. And they look identical, except for one has a tittle, a tagin, or what that means, a crown. It has a crown on it. Two letters that look the same, yoked together, but one wears a crown. What is this a picture of? This is a picture of our Master, our King and our Savior, who invites us to take up his yoke. Come unto me, you who are burdened and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And then he says something ironic. Take my yoke. Wait a minute, yoke? Yoke's for work. When I rest, I take the yoke off, I go in the stable and I eat, or I graze around in the field. I don't put, yokes and rest don't go together. But Yeshua says, take my yoke upon you and learn of me. But that is how we find rest, by taking his yoke upon us. Underneath there, I put the meaning of the letter ket. Ket is the word that starts the word chai. It's the letter that always represents life. L'chaim, to life. And some of you ladies have jewelry that's just a letter ket or a ket yud hanging from a chain. It represents life. Choose life. And this is what life is. When you look at the letter ket, God has given you a miniature picture of what life really is all about. And that is living a life that looks like his. And the only way you do that is by being yoked together. Now, he wears the crown, you don't. All right? But you're yoked together. This is life. You see, death means separation. Life means coming together, being one. Death is always separation. Life is always echad. It's always coming together. So there's no other way to live in God. There's no other way to live the life of Messiah other than by putting his yoke on you. By taking up his yoke. Now think of how a yoke works. A yoke is just a beam of wood with these loops that you put your head in. Right? Now some of us are willing to put our arm in the yoke and do some work. We're willing to put our leg in the yoke and go some places God may want us to go. But there's only one thing he wants put in that yoke, and that's your head. You put your head in the yoke. Your whole head, all your senses, your thoughts, your memories, your emotions, you put that into the yoke. And the way you do that is by putting your head into this book, immersing your mind in this book. This is the yoke of Yeshua. When Yeshua talks about using the yoke, he wasn't making up something new. The rabbis always talk about taking upon ourselves the yoke of Torah. The yoke of Torah, you find it many times, many, many times in the rabbinic writing. So Yeshua says, take my yoke upon you. Learn to do Torah my way, because it's not hard. And you'll find rest. You'll learn of me. And all the things we'll accomplish together. All the places we'll go. And you know, when people see you and you're wearing the yoke of Yeshua, it looks like you're doing half the work. You look at any team of oxen, and there's two of them in a yoke. It looks like they're both doing 50% of the work. We know the secret, though. When we walk yoke to Yeshua, he's doing the work. We're learning of him. We're the learners. We're the students. To the outside, we may look alike. But we know the difference is that we're learning to be like him. Because we have our mind in the same place his mind is. You know, when he tells us, Paul tells us, let this mind be in you, which is also in Messiah Yeshua. And he talks about how Yeshua humbled himself. And then he tells about how God elevated him. See, we need to focus on humbling ourselves and to put on the yoke of Messiah as a humiliating act. But you see, if you try exalting yourself, God promises you, if you exalt yourself, he will humble you. But he also promises that he will exalt the humble. So your responsibility is to humble yourself. You leave it in God's hands to exalt you in due time. That's his responsibility, not yours. When you get those two reversed, what a miserable life that is. What a miserable life. Now, I want to show you something else here that goes right along with this. call this overhead, Death is No Yoke. And it's not meant to be funny, so quit laughing right now. Literally, death is no yoke. That's what death is, separation. But when you're yoked to Yeshua, that's life. Let's look at these names again. Elkanah means redeemed by God or possession of God, God's possession. God redeems. Eli means, it sounds like my God, but it means my yoke. Now, twice in our reading this evening, we came across that word Belial. The first time is in chapter 1, verse 16. Where Eli thinks Hannah is intoxicated. And she says, don't consider your servant a wicked woman. That phrase, wicked woman, is a bat Belial, a daughter of Belial. You know what Belial means? Well, of course you do. It's just written right there. Belial means believe all without a yoke. Got it? Look how it's set up. It's made up of two words. Believe means without. All means yoke. What's Eli's name? Ali, Eli, my yoke. Belial means without a yoke. And Hannah says, I am not a daughter of Belial. I am not one who refuses the yoke. But the last verse we read this evening was 1 Samuel 2:12. Now the sons of Eli were B'nai Belial, sons of Belial. They were men without a yoke. And when you look at how this is read in the Hebrew, here's the whole verse in Hebrew. Uvnei Eli, and the sons, B'nai Eli, there's Eli. Then you have the word B'nai again. Sons, Belial, without a yoke. You see the similarities? The Vav means and, B'nai means sons of. Here's Eli, and the first letter spell yoke. And this says without a yoke. Uvnei Eli, B'nai Belial. And the sons of my yoke were sons without a yoke. Isn't that interesting? It's poetic in the Hebrew. Then it goes on and says, Lo yadu et Adonai. They did not know the Lord. To know something means to be one with it. It tells us that Elkanah knew his wife. She bore fruit. To know God means to be one with him. If you just know about him, that's just some knowledge. But that doesn't mean you're one with him. To truly know God means to become one. Knowledge in Hebraic thought means to truly know something, truly be one with it. And whenever you truly know something, it always bears fruit. It brings forth fruit. Jim, I saw your hand up.
Is there any indication Eli's
sons was spoiled. Oh, yeah. Yes. I think so. Next week, in the second half of chapter 2, the question was, were Eli's sons spoiled? And yes, absolutely. And did Eli's life have bearing on his sons' lives? It would seem to be. It would seem that he did. Because he's warned about his sons. And God more or less chews him out through means of a prophet about his two sons. Now, you know, Samuel's sons didn't turn out too great either. In fact, some of God's kids didn't turn out too good. Just because kids don't turn out doesn't mean you're a lousy parent. But being a lousy parent will probably produce lousy kids. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. I shouldn't put that. That's a nice thing to say, lousy kids. Those are things, lousy kids. Misdirected children. Okay? That's what I should say. It's not lousy. Poor choice. Yes. The old teacher rising up. It's ugly head in me. Do you see how these things are fitting together? So it's amazing how this is. And this is all kind of encapsulated in those opening verses. So there are a couple stories going on here. There's the story of Elkanah and Hannah. But there's also another story of Eli and his sons. And Hannah's son is getting ready to replace Eli and his sons. Samuel is going to replace the whole lot of them. Because as we read later on, Eli's sons and Eli all die pretty much the same day. And Samuel replaces the lot of them. Well, let's go on a little bit more. Let's go back to chapter 1. And I want us to notice something that's very important here. You should underline this in your Bibles. In chapter 1, verse 5, it says that to Hannah he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but Adonai had closed her womb. Who had closed her womb? The Lord did. Was it because she was a bad person? It was just the opposite. Because God wanted something very special from this woman. And then to emphasize it, it's repeated in the next verse, in verse 6. Her rival, Peninnah, provoked her again and again in order to irritate her because Adonai had closed her womb. Why did God close her womb? Her name means favor. Her name means grace. And we know that children are a blessing of the Lord. So Peninnah has all these blessings and Hannah has none. And I'm sure the enemy would come along with Hannah and say, oh, you're not in favor of God. Your name is a mockery. Favored of God. If God favored you to give you children. You can't even fulfill the first commandment, be fruitful and multiply. Very first commandment in the Bible, you can't even do that one. But if you had God's blessing, if God loved you, if you're doing things right, you would have lots of children. Imagine how torn she was in her heart. How torn she was. But there's a phrase in Judaism I want you to memorize. It's very easy. It takes a long time to understand it. I don't understand it fully yet, but I'm getting a handle on it. And Robin and I have discussed this a lot of times. And that's this. You ready? The problem is the solution. The problem is the solution. You can take whatever problem in your life right now. I don't care what it is. Whatever that problem is, contained in that problem is the solution itself. Not just to the problem, but something far-reaching. Now, I don't know if I can really explain that concept, but I know it's true. I've experienced it, and I've seen it work in the lives of so many others. But how do you define a problem? Usually a problem is something that really makes you feel uncomfortable, causes pain, and causes suffering. If you don't experience suffering and pain and discomfort, then you figure I don't have any problems. And, you know, it's interesting that when Eli sees Hannah praying in the courtyard, he says, put your wine away from you. And she says, I have not drunk any wine or strong drink. In other words, I haven't poured any wine in. She says, I've poured my spirit out to the Lord. That's an important lesson. Because you know what a lot of people do when they experience pain, they want to start pouring in the painkillers. Now, those painkillers can come in the form of pills or alcohol or drugs or some other type of therapy. And I'm not against good, healthy, wise therapy, but it's a very rare thing to find. But we try to pour things in. We try to read books. We try to do this. And go to conferences. And get this and get that. And we're trying to pour stuff in to fix the problem instead of pouring our spirits out to the Lord. Silently. Remember, he couldn't hear what she was saying. She was weeping. But she wasn't making a lot of noise. And even when her husband comes to her, says, Hannah, you know, he gave her double portion. Hannah, haven't I been good to you better than 10 sons? Why are you crying? What was her answer? She didn't answer him. He knew what the problem was. No good discussing it. Her problem was with God. Her problem was with the Lord. So her problem is this. There's a big problem in Israel. Eli's sons, who were about to replace them, were sons of Belial. They were sons without a yoke. They did not know God. They had to be removed. So what does God do? He seals up Hannah's womb. Hannah had no idea that her sealed up womb had anything to do with Eli and his two awful sons. She had no idea that her son had anything to do with placing two kings on the throne of Israel. She had no idea that her sealed up womb would produce 1st and 2nd Samuel for us. She had no idea. All she knew was a big problem. If she could have gotten a glimpse of the solution that would go on for millennia later, to where in 2008 a bunch of people were sitting here studying this godly woman and her sealed up womb, there would have been no suffering. You see how well the problem itself is the solution, not just to the problem, but it reaches out and bleeds over into, it just goes on forever. Don't let your suffering be wasted. Don't ever let it be wasted. Because in that suffering, sometimes what we call suffering is God's embrace. He hugs hard, and sometimes it hurts. Boy, he brings out such good stuff. So, how does God solve the problem? Well, he brings along Elkanah, who's going to be the father of this prophet. He gives Hannah a heart for God, but not a fruitful womb. And she's going to become the mother of this prophet. But God closes her womb. Why? To drive her to prayer. And what happened in all this pain? Now, here's something I want you to catch. This is very important. I'm sure when Hannah started her prayers for over however many years, and she started praying, she's praying that God give her a son to give to her husband. But by the time we meet her here in the end of chapter 1, she's asking her son to give to God. Now, finally she got the formula right, and God gives her son. So many times when I pray, it's not so much so I can get something from God, it's because God wants something from me. And as I pray and I work through it and I refine and God works on me and kind of sands me down and smooths me off, and that request gets transformed into something kind of the same but then a lot different from what I started out with. And finally God says, okay, that's what I've been waiting for you to ask for. And here we go. So God closes her womb to drive her to prayer. And then, not only that, but along comes Peninna to just agitate her, to attack, to do all that. And you notice when she does it, this is not coincidence. Look what it says in chapter 1, verse 7. This is what he would do year after year, Elkanah. And whenever Peninna would go up to the house of Adonai, she would provoke her. Isn't that something? When they would go and get ready to go towards the house of the Lord, they would be making this pilgrimage journey, then Peninna would just start firing up her mouth and going after Hannah. How many times is it when you're getting ready to assemble together, and I know why my wife is laughing, that we can almost expect it. You know, it rolls around 4 o'clock or 3:34, it's about time they're getting ready to go. It's just like the enemy says, oh, I got to get in there to do everything I can to discourage them from going tonight. And I know he must do the same with you. So when you're on the pilgrimage, you're getting ready to go to the house of the Lord, to congregate with God's people. And then he says, ooh, can't let that happen. Got to get in there and put some speed bumps in their way. And that's exactly what happened here. Why things haven't changed. But just remember this. If the enemy, recognize the enemy. If you realize the enemy's trying to keep you from going there, that must be pretty important for God for me to get there. So, where do we leave off? Oh, yeah. So Peninna's there to persecute and cause mischief. But what did that do? It made her pray more. It made the pain more intense and made her pray even harder. Then finally, Hannah makes a desperate promise to God. And then what happens when she makes her promise to God? She's accused of being a drunk. Isn't that something? She's right there doing the very thing God wants her to do. She's making this oath. This is what God has been bringing her to this very point, possibly over many years. I mean, if she was the first wife, and over a period of time, let's say 2 or 3 years, it became obvious she's barren, Then Elkanah marries Peninnah, and Peninnah. Peninnah started having, I don't know how many children, 7, 8, 10 kids. That took place over a period of years. So probably Hannah's been suffering like this for maybe 10 years' time. And finally, at this day, this hour, this very moment, she's in there praying to God, making this vow to him, and along comes Eli. Why do you bring your drunkenness in here? Isn't that something? Robin.
That they were often drunk.
Yes.
And that he was so accustomed to their drunkenness that that became spoken.
Good point.
He imposed that on her immediately.
Yeah.
We do that. We impose whatever our focus is.
Yes. Good point.
Now,
this is one of the things people who get the tapes will say, why don't you repeat things? That was worth repeating. Robin was sharing that Eli is probably used to seeing his own sons drunk in the courtyard. So immediately when he sees several kinds of behavior, he imposes that on them, assumes that they also are inebriated. But what's Hannah's response? Now, this is so important. This may be the most important thing you hear tonight. If Hannah was like most people, she'd say, well, she would have turned on her heel and walked out of there, maybe given Eli a piece of her mind and left. She'd have had a bad church experience. You know, and the pastor came down on her because she was more spiritual than he was, you know, and she was falsely accused. You know, it's the whole thing. And like most people, she would just climb out of here. I'm never coming back to this place again. I prayed for kids for years. I just want to do God's will. I come in here and I pray to make it vows, and the high priest accuses me of being drunk. I'm done with the whole thing. And if she had done that, she would have missed the blessing, and the pain would it have ever been resolved? Would she have ever received the child? Or if she had, would it ever be the Samuel that this child grew to be? So what was her response? A soft heart and a gentle answer. And she begs of him, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of a grieved spirit. No, I'm not drunk. I have a broken heart. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink. I've been pouring things in, but I have poured out my soul before Adonai. Please do not deem your maidservant, you who falsely accused me of being a drunk," she still calls herself his maidservant, "don't call me a daughter without a yoke. I wear a yoke. I'm yoked to the same God you serve." And the very one who was the false accuser became the one who blessed. And I think too many times when we have a quick, sharp response to someone who says something unpleasant to us, and we turn around and we turn our back on that person and want to exclude them from our lives, I think we also miss a tremendous blessing that that person could bring if we would continue the relationship and give it a chance. And you know, I praise God, and I thank God so much for Rob's prayers, and where he's talking about Beth Tacoum being a safe place. And Rob, when he's praying, said something to the effect of, he doesn't see gossip here, doesn't see backbiting, doesn't see personal attacks. And I just pray it always stays that way. Because if it doesn't, I'm leaving. So, but you know, it is a safe place, and I see people that sometimes somebody's in a bad mood, and maybe you don't treat someone as loving as you should, but I see others treat you loving back, and everything's healed and smoothed over, and that love covers a multitude of sins, and what could fester to something bad, it doesn't. It's not given a chance, because you're both bent on loving one another and taking that commandment very seriously, and it's fruitful. It pays off. And you have peace in your life because of it. Yeah, Dia.
Thank you. There's a difference, and I got it in this part. The priest that is, I guess, lost one of them, she ends up giving him Samuel, and how did she trust him? She was pretty sure of, right?
Yeah.
So she tried to make her.
I'd wonder the same thing. How could you trust her, Samuel, living with this motley crew of Hophni and Phinehas and Eli? Well, I think she was a desperate woman when she made that vow to God, but God took her up on it. So God took her up on it. He must want her to follow through with it. But she did visit him year to year, from year to year. And don't you know she prayed for that boy like nobody's business? Oh, can you imagine the prayers? Yeah, Ron.
It's a good question for Dee. I think her trust was not in Eli, her trust was in Adonai.
Yes, her trust was not in Eli, her trust was in Adonai. Yes, good point. Yeah, Phil.
Well, I have to say, you know, something kind of stands out to me is after being accused of her being drunk and looking at him that way, she responded to him. I'm looking at her response, and she didn't really seem to say anything in her response about other than just that she was pouring out her spirit. She didn't say anything about what she said. And his immediate response is to recognize it seems that she had made a petition. Mm-hmm. It seems kind of odd to me that she hadn't said that. So it just seems like I'm wondering if for everything we're talking about, it may in that moment the first view.
It's possible. Right. Yeah, she doesn't specify exactly what her request is. And we don't even know if Eli even knew what it was. But he did say, go in peace. The God of Israel grant the request you've made of him. But there's an interesting thing here. Maybe this is a key. Did you notice how a couple of times so far, God has been referred to as Adonai, master of legions, master of armies? Adonai Zevaot is the Hebrew term. It's found in chapter 1, verse 3. And it's found again over in verse 11. Hannah, when she's praying, she makes a vow, Adonai, master of legions. But when Eli blesses her, what term does he use? Adonai, master of legions? No. He says, go in peace, the God of Israel. The Elohe Yisrael. He will give you your request. Now, why the difference in term? What is God, do you think, pointing out from this? I think so many times we want to call upon God's power. And we want to remind God how powerful it is to answer our prayers. Then God says, listen, yeah, I'm powerful. All right, we got that down. But it's my relationship with you. It's the family ties we have. It's the love I have for you that really matters here. I got all the power that you could possibly imagine. Limitless power. But I'm the God of Israel. Israel, your ancestor. The one who used to be called Jacob, the one I wrestled with, I had to break him too. Until I made him a man after my heart and changed his name from Heel to Prince of God. And I'm that God. And I made a covenant with his grandfather Abraham. I made a covenant with his father Isaac. And I made it with Israel and with all of his children, including you. I'm responsible for you. I love you. You're my kid. And it's almost like she had to be reminded, okay, it's not the master of armies I need to pray to. It's my Abba, my Father. You see, that close God is so near. And she maybe had to be reminded how near he was, how close he was. I don't know, just a thought. Well, let's close with this. No, maybe let's just close. That'd be good. Let's just close. That's good enough. I was going to point out that this wonderful hymn of praise, you could look at it. It seems like a hymn of praise that someone would pray after they'd won a big battle. Not after you have a baby. But then Robin reminded me, well, having a baby is kind of like going through warfare. But as I read that, that's where she's proclaiming God's power. You know, he kills and he brings the life and he casts down and he raises up. And there's all these words about horns, like on a beast, you know, and power and strength. And it struck me that in God's economy, in the spiritual realm, wherever there's new life, it's like a great war has been won. Life is victory itself. And you know, when I look at nature, I was out the other day and I noticed the crack of the driveway and there's just this little tiny crack, little tiny thing. And already there's some grass and stuff. It found a foothold, enough of an opportunity for life, and life sprung forth. And the snow was still melting in our backyard the other day, and I noticed some purple flowers poking up through the dirt. First chance to pop up, and here they come. It's like God's life is just there, potent to burst forth. And every time it bursts forth, it's like a victory song. It's like it has won another battle over death itself. So no wonder Hannah sings this great hymn of battle victory, because she has a little boy that she's going to give to God. Wherever we bring forth life, we have crushed the serpent's head, I believe. We've won a mighty victory. So choose life and promote it, and bring life out in one another, in your wife, your husband, your kids, your neighbors, and catch them being good and encourage them in those good works. And just keep fanning the flame of life wherever you see it. And that's how we win this war. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together. Thank you for the many lessons we could learn in these few words, these handful of words you've given us so far in 1 Samuel. Continue to open our eyes to the truths and the things you would teach us there. And I pray, Father, that we would learn the lesson of Hannah, that suffering always has a great purpose. And in the problem resides the solution, not only to the problem, but to so many things, eternal things, that we don't have the eyes to see yet. So, Lord, I pray that you give us the strength to hold on to your truth as we go through our pain. So, Lord, you don't just take us into suffering and leave us there. And often you don't allow us to avoid suffering when we'd like you to. But you do take us through it. And even as Yeshua suffered on the cross, the scriptures tell us that because of the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame. So, Father, I pray you give us that kind of focus, that we can see there is something on the other side of suffering. There is another side to the pain. There is an end to it. And we can have joy. And we can endure and make it through and out the other side. So, Lord, we ask you for that strength, the strength that comes only from truth. And we'll give you the praise and the glory for it. In Yeshua's name, amen.